The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today I'm joined by Ted Walter and Mick Harrison. Ted Walter is the Director of Strategy and Development at AE 9/11 Truth. He holds a Master of Public Policy degree from the University of California, Berkeley. And prior to his current role with AE 9/11 Truth, he was the director of NYC CAN's 2014 High-Rise Safety Initiative. He was a volunteer campaign manager for AE 9/11 Truth's Rethink 9/11 campaign way back in 2013. And he was the director of NYC CAN's 2009 Ballot Initiative. He's also the author of Beyond Misinformation, What Science Says About the Destruction of World Trade Center Buildings 1, 2, and 7, and that's going to be front and center, that information, in today's discussion. Ted, welcome back to 9/11 Freefall.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be here.
And Mick Harrison is a public interest attorney. He's a graduate summa cum laude of the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. And he has a national practice focused on cases that involve whistleblower protection, government accountability, corporate fraud and false claims, and dangers to public health or the environment. He is the director of litigation for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, doing a lot of great work. Mick Harrison, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Andy.
So the reason that I have these two gentlemen on here today is because AE 9/11 Truth has taken another step in fighting this big lie. They have filed a request for correction with NIST, and we're going to be talking about that. We're going to start off with Mick. Please begin by telling our audience what's involved in a request for correction, your role in this process, and how specifically are you using it with NIST?
Well, this request is focused on one of the three buildings that fell on 9/11, World Trade Center 7. My role was as a legal consultant. I was acting in my capacity as a lawyer, not on behalf of the Lawyers Committee. The Lawyers Committee did approve my role in assisting architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, which I was honored to do in this task. I think it's very important. The basic legal concept underlying it is that the Information Quality Act allows citizens to request or petition an agency to correct factual information that is wrong, that is based on, you know, shoddy research, poor logic, bad science, and essentially request that it be corrected and republished in an accurate form so that, you know, proper policy decisions can be based on good information instead of bad information. And I'm sure Ted will help you understand the details of the content. And it's I was very impressed with the work that Ted and his colleagues at Architects and Engineers did on this, and I think when folks get a chance to read it, they will be as well. It's very thorough, it's very persuasive, it's very well documented, and it should convince the National Institutes of Standards and Technology to correct their World Trade Center 7 report and acknowledge that their theory of collapse was wrong, and that the theory that fits the evidence is the one that we've all been talking about, unfortunately, which is use of explosives and incendiaries.
Right on. I was browsing it this morning, and a lot of great information in there, and I mean, stuff that a lot of the truth movement knows already that should be able to sway anyone who looks at it with intellectual honesty. But we know what we're up against and the stonewalling that we have received. But I love that we're taking this route and we're getting it on the record that NIST has been notified. We're going through the proper channels. Ted, talk about some of the points of contention with the official story that are being raised in this specific request for correction.
Sure. The overall purpose, as Mick spoke to, but to go a little bit deeper into it, is to of what the document is doing is demonstrating that NIST has violated its own guidelines and information quality standards in publishing this report and several aspects of the report. And there are a number of standards that essentially govern that they have to live up to when they publish a report like this or when they do any research and disseminate any information. And those have to do with objectivity, transparency, reproducibility, and a few others. What the document is demonstrating is that at least in eight different areas that we showed the NIST World Trade Center 7 report violates some of those information quality standards. So five of the areas of information that we chose to focus on have to do with how NIST modeled the collapse of the building. Many of those are specifically about the event that NIST says initiated the collapse, which, as some of our listeners know, but most people don't know, is essentially on one particular floor of the building, several beams expanded, pushed a girder off its seat, and that caused this cascade of floor failures, which then left a single column unsupported, and then that column buckled. All of that is what NIST says is the initiating event of this collapse. And so we look at several different steps in that process and show that each one of those steps, based on various information, the drawings of the building, as well as the analysis that was conducted by Professor Leroy Halsey at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, we're able to show that those steps are impossible. There are certain things that NIST did in their modeling that was not accurate. For example, they left off a specific structural feature in their model, which they acknowledged several years ago, which, if you include that structural feature, actually makes that collapse initiation mechanism impossible. So about half to two-thirds of the request is focused on these different modeling issues. And probably actually the biggest one that the request spends the most time on is NIST's claim that its global collapse analysis matches the observed behavior reasonably well, which are the words that NIST used in the report. So we very methodically show how NIST's global collapse analysis does not match the observed behavior whatsoever. And so that's part of it. The other part, second half of the request, as people can see when they go read it, is various evidence related to the use of explosives and incendiaries that NIST either distorted or omitted from its report. And one area that's really ironclad in my view, and I think in Mick's view as well, is the seismic evidence that there were explosions happening during the course of Building 7's collapse. In particular, two powerful seismic signals that were emitted right when the first part of the collapse started to happen, the beginning of the east penthouse going down, and then 7 to 8 seconds later at the initiation of global collapse. And so André Rousseau, who's a geophysicist in France, actually provided a declaration, which is part of this request, essentially testifying that these seismic signals, which were recorded at Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory about, 30 kilometers away from ground zero, picked up these seismic signals and that these signals were generated by explosions. And then there's the two other areas are the eyewitness and audio evidence of explosions. And finally, the steel that was recovered from Building 7 that experienced extreme erosion and sulfidation and oxidation, which many people in the 9/11 Truth Movement are familiar with, but of course not necessarily in the broader public. And so the upshot is that NIST collapse theory is both physically impossible, could not have happened, and it is also inconsistent with all of this evidence that exists. And the request for correction process gives us an avenue in which to methodically go through the NIST report and demonstrate the ways in which, because of these failings, the NIST report is not in compliance with NIST's own information quality standards. And our hope is that NIST will, as Mick said, be persuaded and will see that their report fails to comply with their own information quality standards and that NIST will revise its report. The ultimate request, which is communicated at each point of the document, is for NIST to discard its probable collapse sequence, which is essentially its theory of how the building came down, and develop a new probable collapse sequence that is physically possible and that is consistent with all the evidence that's presented in the request.
I mean, it doesn't comply with their own standards. It doesn't comply with common sense. And I think this is a great next step, and just we got to keep on laying the pressure on them and make them know that we are not going away. I'm very happy with this development today. Now, when I was looking over the request for correction, I see that there's an area at the end for names and signatures. So there's going to be a number of people who have put their name to this. Can you talk a little bit about that, Ted?
Yes. So the request is actually signed by not only Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, the organization is one of the requesters, but also 10 9/11 family members have joined us in submitting this request. So each of them are also individually requesters, as well as about 88 structural engineers and architects who are affiliated with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So I think most of them, if not all of them, have signed our petition, but they've also chosen to join the request as individual requesters. So we essentially have three categories of requesters: the family members, individual structural engineers and architects, and then the organization Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So it was, I'll just say, it was heartening and fulfilling to be working with so many people, to have so many people so enthusiastically sign on to this request, and in particular to have the support of many 9/11 family members, and to know that we are working on their behalf to try to help uncover the truth about what happened as far as the murder of their loved ones is obviously, that gives us a lot of encouragement and energy to keep going and to do what we're doing.
So I'd like to know, because we know what we're up against and we know who we're dealing with, at least as an agency, you know, considering the process involved and all the pages of information being laid on them now, can NIST just get away with just simply stating we stand by our report as they have in the past when they're challenged, or do they need to go through this and address each point? And that's a question for Mick.
Well, there's a federal law called the Administrative Procedures Act, the APA, which allows citizens to sue a federal agency if the agency takes an action that is arbitrary and capricious or contrary to law. And in this case, if NIST were to simply thumb its nose at this very well articulated request for correction, extremely well documented, yeah, it would be an arbitrary action. This is one of those areas where there's so much scientific evidence, multiple independent lines of it, which corroborate each other, that you got one of those Sherlock Holmes moments where the famous author Arthur Conan Doyle said, by way of his character, when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever else remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And even though NIST seems to want to not embrace the possibility of use of explosives and continues to want to say it's improbable, and I note that they called their own theory a probable collapse sequence. They didn't say it was established by science as a definite explanation. But in this case, if you read this request for correction by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, you'll see that at this point the evidence is in fact dispositive. As we say, there is no other alternative. No other explanation can really explain these multiple lines of evidence, which all converge on the explanation that explosives and incendiaries were used. So if NIST were to thumb their nose at this, they would be acting arbitrarily and capriciously. So my own reading is the courts are, you know, they haven't had too many of these cases under the Information Quality Act. They had a few. And my reading of the cases is that the courts recognize that the Administrative Procedures Act is available as a vehicle for appealing an agency denial of a petition or request for correction like this. And the only issue that may come up would be an issue that often comes up in public interest cases, probably more than it should, which is a procedural one having to do with the standing of the plaintiffs. But in this case, for the reason you just sort of articulated with Ted, that you've got so many petitioners here, family members of folks who were lost in 9/11, architects and engineers, plus the organization, AE for 9/11 Truth, that in my view, there really is no issue there either. So I'm cautiously optimistic, and I certainly hope we don't have to go there, but I'm cautiously optimistic that judicial review will be available to hold the agency, NIST, to account. If they were to deny this request, I would hasten to add, though, that this is so well done. And I know a lot of folks in the 9/11 Truth Movement will be skeptical that at this point any federal agency will do anything correct on this issue. But I do think that Ted and his colleagues who assisted on this, Tony Sambodi and others, did such an excellent job that NIST is pretty well boxed in here. So we may not have to go that route of judicial review. And let me just add a litigation-related note on this. Some of the listeners will know that my organization, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, Inc., a nonprofit, has done some Freedom of Information Act lawsuits. We have three active against NIST at the moment in federal court, and one of them has to do with Building 7 and is specifically focused on the Column 79 connection that Ted may want to talk about in a little more detail, which is the, as he said, the heart of NIST's probable collapse sequence. But I represent David Cole, a well-known 9/11 researcher, in that FOIA request, and my organization is supporting that litigation. And when David asked for the data regarding the Column 79 connection in Building 7, NIST refused to give it. And they're basically saying that their computer modeling, which is what they base their probable collapse sequence on, is, how shall I say, top double secret. They don't put it that way, but they are saying that they can't release it because, in their view, it might be a danger to public health and safety because, you know, some wrongdoers might study it and learn how to bring down buildings by setting strategic fires in certain locations, which in steel frame buildings has never been done before 9/11, and the evidence now shows was not done on 9/11 either. So NIST is keeping the secret, and they're going to great lengths to keep the data that they say supports their conclusion secret. So it's basically a trust us argument. And in my 30-some years of public interest advocacy, anytime an agency basically tells you something of this importance and says, trust us, we can't tell you why, but this is our conclusion, you need to be really suspicious of it. This is not an exception. And after reading through the excellent request for correction that Ted and his colleagues did, it's clear to me now why NIST is not wanting to release their modeling and the data inputs in their models, because there's no way, if they release that data, that it's not going to become clear to the world, and particularly the scientific community, that this request for correction is entirely correct as a matter of science, and that, you know, NIST should have known that and will now have an obligation to fix it. So they're hiding behind secrecy for reasons which are now clear, and are made clear in this very detailed request for correction.
It is detailed, and I'm glad you said that, because it sort of leads into my next question. Because there's so much great information on here, I mean, I really think this thing could be used for outreach to engineers. It's so well organized and laid out. Is NIST required to argue every point made? Like, is there any back and forth, or can they come out and say, well, you've got 100 pages here pointing out how our story is full of holes, but we stand by it and leave it at that?
Well, Ted, do you want to start with that, or shall I?
I'll take a stab, but you might be able to say more about it than me. There is a provision in the information quality guidelines on NIST's website, which states that if NIST does not take corrective action in regards to a request or any of the requests contained within an overall request document, that it will provide a point-by-point response, and I'm quoting them now, will contain a point-by-point response to any relevant data quality arguments contained in the request. So they are required to respond in some manner. I think that language is a little bit vague, and so they could be very detailed and lengthy in their response, or perhaps they could be relatively short in their response. We have a little bit of precedent in the fact that a group of researchers, including Richard Gage, back in 2007, submitted a request for correction to NIST regarding the Twin Towers investigation. And NIST responded to that request. I wouldn't say that it was truly substantive, but NIST certainly attempted to respond in a scientific manner, in a way that they were, to some extent, going toe-to-toe with the claims being made by Richard Gage and others who joined in that request. I think that their arguments there were not persuasive, but they made an attempt. In this case, you know, I mean, I applaud Richard and the others who were involved in that, and I believe that James Gourley was the person who drafted that request back in 2007, the attorney who's been active in the movement for some time, as some folks know. I think that because the science and because our knowledge in particular about Building 7 and the huge amount of research and scrutiny that has gone into NIST's report on the collapse of Building 7, we've been able to construct a document and a set of claims, as Mick said, that really should box NIST in. It's very hard to imagine a way that NIST could convincingly respond to these claims. And so let me be clear. I know Mick said this earlier, and I say this as well. I think it's absolutely possible that NIST will comply with many or most, if not all, of the requests put forward in this document. But supposing that they don't, I think that they're going to have a lot of trouble answering the claims in a substantive way. And I hope that we will not see a short response, because the information and the evidence that is documented in this merits a very detailed response from NIST, and ultimately does indeed warrant corrective action on NIST's part.
Absolutely, and that is the right thing to do. Now, they're going to have a hard time being boxed in, coming out and saying, yeah, our entire analysis was wrong, which is basically what this amounts to. It's not just one detail here and there that they could correct, and yet the overall story stays the same. I mean, this just completely pulls the rug out from under, and now you get into issues. How much money was spent on this NIST report just for Building 7 alone? And the fact that they took all that time to produce something that was shoddy work, I think that should be national scandal if we didn't have other things dominating the headlines at this moment. And I'm curious on this thought from both of you guys. And the question is, you know, it's almost 20 years after. We're coming close to that. I think we're heading to the 19th anniversary now. People switch out of jobs. I know some of the people who worked on the report may still be at NIST, but you get new blood in there, you get people who weren't involved in this. Do you think that plays in our favor? This can be looked at with fresh eyes over at NIST? We'll start with Ted.
It's a good question. A lot of the personnel that was involved in the World Trade Center investigation at NIST are still there, matter of fact. Many of the principals in the investigation remain there. Dr. Shyam Sunder actually left NIST for some period of time, but then went back. And many of the other lead authors are still there that are head of divisions and so on. I think that there will be some fresh eyes on the request. I don't think that the request is necessarily, and this is my speculation to some extent, but just based on my reading of the provisions and the information quality standards, I think there's a good chance that there'll be some fresh eyes on it. And it actually depends on who is the chief of the division that is going to handle the request, who's the head of that division. NIST has restructured several times in the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years. So I believe the division that was primarily responsible for this investigation is not the same division. So it's not clear to me right now which division is going to handle the request. And we did ask NIST to specifically confirm to us which division is going to be handling it. But there's also a second phase to this, which is if we receive an initial denial from NIST, and that has to come within 4 months, unless I guess we concur and allow it to go for longer than that. But if there is an initial denial, we have 30 days in which to respond and appeal that denial. And then our appeal would go to somebody who was not involved at all doing the initial analysis and the response to our request. And that person, from what I can tell, was, and I'm not going to, I actually don't remember his name and don't remember the exact position right now, but he was definitely not involved in the World Trade Center investigation. So in theory, this is supposed to go to somebody else for a totally objective analysis in the event that we have to appeal an initial denial. So there's every chance that somebody else in NIST might look at this with fresh eyes and perhaps overrule the initial decision by the group that first handles the request.
Anything to add to that, Mick?
Yeah, I just have a couple notes. I think it is a good question, an interesting one. And I don't think we have a crystal ball, so we can't predict what new faces might say about this petition. We can suggest what they should say just by being objective and logical and scientific. But there have been cases in the past where, you know, agency folks who came in the middle of a controversy, looked at it with a new face, actually have changed agency policy and position over time. There have also been cases where, of course, and we've seen them, agencies have sort of circled the wagons and tried to defend their past personnel regardless of the facts. So it could go either way here, but there's so much available in this request for correction to justify a new position that if there is someone in NIST who has integrity and is able to look at this objectively, they've got plenty to defend their new position with if they chose to, you know, grant the request. I remember a short war story here back in, what was it, 1993, something like that. I was doing a case for Greenpeace, a federal lawsuit on a multi-million-dollar hazardous waste incinerator thing. And in those days, EPA was looking at the risks of major combustion sources by just looking at the inhalation route of exposure. And Greenpeace was putting all this evidence that most of us are poisoned by toxic chemicals, not by breathing, even though that can happen, but by eating food, because 99% of the, at least the persistent pollutants accumulate in the food chain, and you get exposed much more that way than by breathing. So we had a whistleblower in the agency give us a secret draft of a new document that agency study that showed what we were saying, that food chain risk was the big issue. And we did end up, to make a long story short, putting that on in evidence in the case. And we won the case initially at the trial, in the trial court, and then on jurisdictional or maybe procedural grounds, that particular lawsuit, positive outcome was reversed. But in the process, the agency did end up changing its policy nationwide and started looking at food chain risk in their risk assessments. So, you know, agency policy and their scientific conclusions can change in the face of new evidence, and this is a good case where it should.
I would have loved to have seen their faces when the internal document came back to haunt them. That is great, and we can only hope for the same thing here. This is a very important development because we are on the march here against the official story. The Building 7 report now has opened the door, and there's going to be more to come. And we're going to keep you informed here on this show. That's why this show exists, to let you know any further developments in this. But Ted, Mick, I want to thank you guys so much for your incredible work and seeking justice for all those people that died on that day by going after the Building 7 issue. And thank you for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much, Andy.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Say have a great week. Good luck.